Which one?
That one.
That's okay. Hi. Good evening. Tonight's presentation is by Dr. Annette Kolodny of the English Department and of the Accredited Women's Studies course. This is the last presentation for this year, and we'll start again on January 22nd.
All right, there's a button on the mic.
That mic.
This mic.
This mic here.
And you want me to press it?
No, it's in right underneath the rubber. Underneath the rubber. See the piece of rubber there?
I see several, yes.
No,
I'll be with you shortly.
See
yes.
The piece of rubber?
Yes.
Right there, the rubber foam.
This rubber, yes.
Underneath there is a little button.
Okay. It's not that women aren't competent. All right.
Let's just point in.
Okay. You think it's on now?
Yeah,
all right. Can you all hear me? Yes. My students know that this will not work, that I can never be recorded, but for those of you who are naive enough to try, am I coming across? Can you all hear me? Yes. Okay, good. We can begin. I'm not really here to talk about women's writing. I'm here to test the electrical machinery. Okay. Just shout if you miss anything. Tonight, I would like to lay to rest a number of foolish assumptions and ghostly half-truths concerning women writers and women's writing, which still somehow continue to lurk around the edges of the women's movement. The first group of assumptions I want to attack is rather old, perhaps on its last legs, and I certainly hope so. But the second is quite recent, and perhaps even more dangerous for that. But both need to be squelched, and now, because taken together, they threaten the development of what ought to be a free-flowering of feminist literature, unhampered by ideology, cultist theory, or preconceived aesthetic expectations. To begin with, let's give the lie once and for all to the notion that, until recently, women were not interested in writing literature and did not, therefore, either contribute to the development of English prose and poetry or dominate the publishing market. The facts prove otherwise. And what they show, both in England and North America, is a steady suppression of those women's documents which in any way questioned contemporary attitudes or exposed the pains and humiliations which women suffered under the various reigning codes of morality and propriety. The facts also reveal a lengthy period of time in the 19th century United States when women virtually dominated the publishing market, both as the best-selling novelists of the day and as the main buyers and readers of fiction. I'm assuming that you can hear me over the buzz, is that right? Yes? Okay, and you've all been fascinated by what I've said so far. This phenomenon proved so overwhelming, in fact, that one contemporary critic was moved to label the period of the 1850s the feminine 50s. So, what I'm going to tell you now are some of the facts of our literary history, and they are as follows. These are the facts, not all those silly assumptions that teachers tell you in their classes. Not teachers, of course, like me, but other teachers. At about the same time that Jane Austen was beginning to conceal from her father and his congregation her attempt at writing novels, Mary Wollstonecraft was writing the first feminist tract. Inspired by the prose of Tom Paine and by the ideals of the French and American revolutions, Wollstonecraft in 1791 questioned whether half the human race were to be denied liberty, equality, and fraternity. More than 50 years later, across the Atlantic, an American essayist and poetess, Margaret Fuller, tried again with a book entitled Woman in the 19th Century. In contrast to these two early polemical tracts, the best-selling women's domestic novels of the feminine 50s, written by writers we no longer read today, writers like Fanny Fern and Susanna Mariah Cummins and Susan Werner, among others, people that I couldn't really ask my American Lit students to read. They would throw the books at me. And the reason is that their novels, their domestic novels, were far more tame than any of the political tracts that had come out earlier. Well, though written by and about women, these novels were limited, constricted, as to what kinds of thoughts their women characters might think or what kinds of feelings they might properly express. As a result, anything that was not either wholly virtuous and Christian had been blotted out, along with any experience, longings, or desires that could not serve utilitarian purposes within the ideal and very middle-class Victorian household. Not too surprisingly, this included not only the struggles of pioneer women on the harsh frontiers and the stories of poor working girls suffering in the cities, but also that entire range of sexuality and sensuality and all those deep longings and desires which make up the innermost realities of most human beings. That, as a subject matter, was considered outré, not appropriate for women to write about or for women even to read about. Then, in 1899, a prominent short story writer named Kate Chopin attempted a novel about a woman's awakening to her own imaginative sensibilities, her sensuality, and her desire for independence. Entitled The Awakening, the novel involved, as part of its heroine's experience, a series of extramarital affairs and finally her suicide. So shocked were critics and librarians alike by what they deemed to be the book's immoral flavor and unseemly subject matter. It wasn't unseemly for men to write about this kind of thing, but for a woman to write about it, shocking, just shocking, they said. Well, they were so incensed that she had dared to write about this that booksellers, librarians, mostly the critics, effectively forced the novel to disappear. Booksellers refused to stock what they called the lewd text in their shops, and prim librarians had it removed from their shelves. Such a reception stopped Kay Chopin from attempting to write again about such a subject, and unfortunately silenced any other women writers who might have been contemplating similar experiments. A silence which, by the way, continued to prevail for at least another generation, a good 25 to 30 years in the United States. It's a long period of silence, at least on the women's part. Like Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, and Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century, Kay Chopin's novel was also a book ahead of its time, and all three suffered similar fates. They shocked and irritated contemporary critics, and except for a very small feminist following, all three disappeared from view. Until recently, in fact, all three volumes continued to be derided, treated condescendingly, or ignored by historians, literary critics, and publishers. Until 3 years ago, neither the Kate Chopin novel nor Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century were available in the United States as paperbacks, and sometimes you couldn't even find them in the libraries. Now, happily, they're all over the place in various inexpensive editions, largely due to the development of women's studies courses and to the development of a rising consciousness amongst women and the demand to read their own writings and find out what their historical heritage really is. It was undoubtedly the suppression and unavailability of such texts, giving the appearance that women hadn't written, which prompted Virginia Woolf to complain of the lack of great women writers to whom she could look for a tradition. Looking back over what seemed to her were centuries of women's silence in a room of one's own, Virginia Woolf comments, "Genius of a sort must have existed among them, as it existed among the working classes, thank you, but certainly it never got itself onto paper. When, however, one reads of a woman possessed by the devils, of a wise woman selling herbs, or even a remarkable man who had a remarkable mother, Then I think we are on the track of a lost novelist, a suppressed poet, or some Emily Bronte who dashed her brains out on the moor, crazed with the torture her gift had put her to. Not that Virginia Woolf was entirely wrong. There were, after all, long centuries when only an unusual woman here and there was taught to read and write. But it is not to the Dark Ages to which I want us to look tonight, but to those last 100 or 200 years when many women, at least in the middle and upper classes, were encouraged to be literate. Why then, if they produced in quantity, as in the feminine 50s, they produced many novels and they were all bestsellers, if these women produced in quantity, why did they not also produce work of lasting quality? And why, barring those whose works were suppressed or banned, did they not leave us a larger legacy? The answers to these questions are many and complex and have to do with the place which women have traditionally occupied in the Western world. Since most of those names, traditionally admitted to the canon of major writers, have often been the experimenters and innovators of their day, we see immediately that women could hardly expect such acknowledgement. Where and when they did attempt experiment and innovation, often enough dealing with their own unhappy experiences of being women, they were silenced one way or another and forced into obscurity. If men could explore the sexuality of their heroes, women were discouraged from doing the same with their heroines. Moreover, while we might assume that paper and pens were as available to the fledgling woman writer as they were to the male, we cannot also assume that the same kind of encouragement was similarly provided, or the same kind of time. A few sentences from Virginia Woolf's diary suggest that her own father might have discouraged her flowering had he lived. Let me read the sentences to you. Father's birthday. He would have been 96. 96, yes, today. And could have been 96, like other people one has known. But mercifully was not. His life would have entirely ended mine. What would have happened? No writing, no books. Inconceivable. And that's how she feels, that she would have lived without writing had her father lived. Clearly, he was discouraging her from this. Catherine Ann Mansfield's diary gives us a rare glimpse into the problems which even the comfortable married woman must face should she attempt authorship. She jotted down the following, and I don't know if she ever gave it to him, though it's clearly addressed to him. She jotted down the following during the early days of her relationship with critic John Middleton Murray, when they both dreamed of becoming great writers. It was to be the love affair of the century, you must realize. They were both going to be the great writers. Of course, everybody knows that Catherine Ann Mansfield. You've all forgotten John Middleton Murray. You haven't missed anything. He was a critic, though, and he was a friend of Lawrence's. But they both dreamed that they were going to be great writers, and they were going to have this perfect relationship in which they both encouraged each other to write. This is what she jotted down in her diary, and someday she meant to give it to him. The house seems to take up so much time. I mean, when I have to clean up twice over or wash up extra unnecessary things. I get frightfully impatient and want to be writing. So often this week, you and Gordon have been talking while I washed dishes. Well, someone's got to wash dishes and get food. Otherwise, and this is in quotes, so it's clearly his statement, otherwise, quote, there's nothing in the house but eggs to eat. And after you have gone, I walk about with a mind full of ghosts, of saucepans and Primus stoves, and will there be enough to go around? And you calling, whatever I am doing, even if I am writing, Tig, isn't there going to be tea? It's 5 o'clock. I loathe myself today. This woman who superintends you and rushes about slamming doors and slopping water and shouts, you might at least empty the pail and wash out the tea leaves. Oh, Jack, I wish that you would take me in your arms and kiss my hands and my face and every bit of me and say, it's all right, you darling thing. I understand. Housework. Ah, woman's work is never done. For the woman who is married with children and has the added misfortune to be poor, the obstacles to authorship have been almost insurmountable. Tilly Olson, an American writer of rare talent, but a writer who has to date produced only a very short collection of stories and a single essay. She allows us a glimpse into the particular hardships of the talented poor. Born in 1913 into a family of immigrants, Tilly Olson subsequently married, and not at all prosperously, raised a family, and to help boost the family's inadequate income, she took part-time or full-time jobs whenever she could. Quote from her, "In the 20 years I bore and reared my children and usually had to work at a job as well, the simplest circumstances for creation did not exist. Nevertheless, writing, the hope of it, was the air I breathed." In an essay of hers, only recently published, which tries to examine the various reasons that writers don't write, she looks particularly what she calls the gifted among women and concludes that, quote, "they have remained mute or have never attained full capacity because of circumstances, inner or outer, which oppose the needs of creation." Undoubtedly, making use of her own life experience of thwarted ambitions, she suggests that, quote, "women are traditionally trained to place others' needs first, to feel these needs as their own, making it possible for others to use their abilities. The very fact," and these are all her words, "that these are often needs of love, not duty," she explains, "make women particularly vulnerable to them. That there is no one else to be responsible for these needs," she says, "gives them primacy." As an example, she points to the demands of motherhood, quote, "more than in any other human relationship, overwhelmingly more, motherhood means being instantly interruptible, responsive, responsible. Children need one now. As a result," she sadly concludes, "it is distraction, not meditation, that becomes habitual, interruption, not continuity." And then, perhaps fearful of what has happened to her, she notes in this essay, "unused capacities atrophy. They cease to be." When invited to a dinner given by a women's seminar that had studied her work at a small college in the United States recently, she spoke quite openly about her own plight as a writer. After describing to the women there her full-time job, her housework, her stolen snatches of time on a bus or late at night, refusing to sleep in hopes of getting something down on paper, she told the women there, quote, "it is no accident that the first work I considered publishable began, I stand here ironing, and what you asked me moves tormented back and forth with the iron." That first published work was her prize-winning short story, "I Stand Here Ironing." It gives us, in first-person monologue form, a poor working mother's reflections about her eldest daughter, now a high school student, whose teacher, or perhaps social worker, has sent a worried note home about her. The themes, poverty, a young girl's thwarted life, and a mother's anxious but helpless love, are all literally moved to the rhythms of the ironing board, and thematically to the emotional rhythms of anxiety and thwarted hopes, and the vulnerability of the poor and the powerless. And it is certainly an autobiographical short story in spirit, if not in fact. But a number of young feminists look at Tilly Olson and say, "Ah, well, she was born in 1913. She's just an old lady. She was born before the movement got started." And I've heard this at conferences. And I've heard younger women writers say, "We all have our raised consciousnesses now, and we won't allow ourselves to be silenced, even by poverty, even by motherhood." And it's the kind of statement where I want to applaud the zeal, but I caution you, if any of you think that you want to make the same kind of statement, that even with a raised consciousness, the problems which faced Tilly Olson are still with us. So I'm going to ask you to look in a minute at the excerpt from a recent poem by a young and avowedly militant feminist poet named Alta. I gave you some sheets, and this is on the first page, I hope. It is a selection from Alta's poem, placenta previa, cesarean. All right? Do you all have that? Let me read the section to you. The poem is in several sections. The first part, which you do not have, depicts her coming to consciousness of the fact that she is giving birth, and that she's giving birth by cesarean. The child is premature, and the first thing she discovers upon coming to consciousness is that she begs to see the child, and nobody in the hospital will allow her to see the child. She doesn't even know what sex it is, but they've protected it by putting it away in a nice, neat storage compartment, and never the mother shall see it until the hospital decides that they're ready to let her see it. That's the first part of the poem. It's a fairly painful experience, because she really doesn't know how the child is. The child lives, and as you discover, it's a healthy little infant that appears in the section from part two that I've given you. Let me read it with you. When do I know I did all right? If I die before she does, then did I do all right? Her every fear terrifies me. She's talking about her older daughter, who's 7 years old at this point. Her every fear terrifies me. Sometimes I think no one likes me, she confessed. Sometimes I think you're all pretending, and I wait for news from her father. I wait for her to mention him. I wait and wait. The function of a woman is to wait. I read and leaned back in the rocking chair, relieved that I finally knew what I was for and why. With her in my belly, I was a lady in waiting. Of course, she's punning on the old notion of the lady in court who is a lady in waiting, and she's turning it into the waiting period of pregnancy. But I'm still waiting, and she was born in 1964. Maybe we are happy and just don't know it. The baby, sucking her bottle and holding onto my knee, and this is the infant, as I write this, my belly twisting with pain. If I go to the other room, she will follow me there. I am not yet allowed any perspective. And how right is it to shut her out of the room so I can write about her? How human, how loving, how can I even try to name her? Maybe they could manage without me. Maybe I could steal away a little time in a different room. Would they all still love me when I came back? And that's the end of that part, anyway, of the excerpt. It is clearly Alta's voice which we hear in the poem. The voice of a mother with a 7-year-old first daughter and an infant second daughter, both of whom demand and command her attention and dwindling energies. As with Tilly Olson, Alta, too, was finally separated from her husband. And in this section of the poem, she is clearly without him. The section I have excerpted for you begins with every mother's concern over her child, especially her first. Did I do a good job? Have I been a good mother? But the statement of concern which begins this excerpt changes gradually into a mixture of concern and resentment. She loves her children and even wants to write about them. But their constant demands upon her mean that she is not permitted the perspective, that is, the space, the time, the privacy she requires in order to write. If the excerpt has been typed correctly on the sheets you have, then the word perspective is set off itself, lonely, which is exactly what she's been asking for. The word perspective is set off so it's away from the rest of the poem, and she wishes to be away ever so briefly from the children. It has its own space around it, and it has its own time. And that's desperately what she needs in the poem. She loves the children. She doesn't want to reject them. But they take up her space, her time, her privacy. She has no, and she images it beautifully so that it's physically appealing to you, perspective. Well, so much for some of the problems about trying to write, even when you have a great family and you love them all madly. They do take up your time, at least if you're a woman. Finally, in this poem, the tension between her desire to write and her desire to be a good mother to her children leads only to anxiety and guilt. There is really no resolution in the poem. Time becomes something that is not hers by right, but must be stolen. Read the line, "Can I steal a little time?" And should she steal a bit of it for herself, a little time in a different room, she desperately fears she will lose the children's love. Would they all still love me when I came back? You see the kind of anxiety and guilt. Clearly, the problems which Tilly Olson faced are still with us. And even the militant statements of youthful poets like Alter, who I believe is about my age, about 31, only serve notice that much needs to be done if we are to have the women writers we would so much like to be reading. We live wrong, Alter concludes this poem. And the concluding section is, we live wrong. Our lives are wrong. To trap us in houses with no help, to be sole guardians of little people, our lives are wrong. And the best she can do in the poem is to protest the situation, but there's certainly no resolution. But besides this note of protest in the poem, there is still another thread running through it, which indicates a wholly different problem which women writers are now confronting. You see a brief reference to it in the lines on your sheet. And how right is it to shut her out of the room so I can write about her? How human, how loving, how can I even try to name her? Ostensibly, this is another statement of Alta's guilt. That is, how dare she try to write about, name, describe the very child whom she has just shut out of the room? But more subtly, these lines pose still another problem, the confused problem of knowing and naming a being still in the process of becoming. How do we begin to name that which we do not yet know? In this case, the unknown is a little girl. In other women's writings, the unknown and thereby unnameable is the experience of what it means to be a woman. Which explains in part, in case you've been wondering, why I took for the title of this lecture a line from a Margaret Atwood poem, I Can't Tell You My Name, and brings me at last to the second group of assumptions which I hope to lay to rest tonight. As I said, these are more recent and may, as a result, be far more lethal. Catering to women's urgent need to understand their own experience, to resurrect their rightful place in history and rediscover their literary heritage, too much of the literary criticism coming out of the feminist movement nowadays is rushing to put labels on things and pin us all down with neat patterns and attractive names. I think if we are to take seriously the potential contribution we are to make as women to the world of letters, then we dare not let ourselves be too naively caught up in the assumption that because of the sudden outpouring of women writers now available to us, and everybody's busy publishing them, we are about to discover the components of our unique and universal feminine consciousness and develop once and for all a unique feminine literary style appropriate to that consciousness. And there go my students squirming because they know I've published quite the opposite and I'm now doing a great about face before your very eyes. But what bothers me about this is that this kind of pigeonholing, I fear, will trap us just as dangerously as did the 19th century morality codes that silenced Kate Chopin. Still, I know the idea is an attractive one. And any group that begins to feel its power wants also to discover that which is uniquely its own. In this case, the search for a unique feminine literary style goes back to Virginia Woolf's musings in A Room of One's Own. In that little book, she had argued that the great women novelists of the 19th century suffered from a lack of feminine tradition and style. The sentence which was given to the Bronte sisters, Jane Austen and George Eliot, was a sentence forged by male sensitivities, she claimed. The women writers had, in short, to deal with a stylistic tradition that was fundamentally alien to their own way of thinking. It was almost as if they had to write in a foreign language. Before we naively accept the implications of such a statement and pursue the kind of feminist criticism to which it has led in recent years, we must examine the two fundamental assumptions which her analysis takes for granted. First, that there is such a thing as a unique and identifiable universal feminine mind, and second, that there is, or ought to be, a feminine literary style appropriate to that mind. The trouble with such assumptions, of course, is that they are so difficult to pin down. The writers and critics who make use of them never bother to tell us whether by their phrases, feminine mind or unique feminine consciousness, they are referring to something inherently fixed as a biological or physiological necessity, or whether they are referring to what is different in women's experience or perception, or some combination thereof. That is, they never bother to tell us whether what they refer to as unique is a product of biology, evolution, historical accident, or current patterns of socialization. And I, for one, am convinced that these are important distinctions, which cannot be ignored and simply tossed off as irrelevant. What concerns me even more, however, is the kind of criticism to which these kinds of assumptions have given rise. One article, at least, of my own. In an article entitled Feminist Style Criticism, a young American feminist critic named Josephine Donovan begins her article by assuming the fact of something like, quote, a feminine mode or feminine sentence. She gives weight to this view by quoting, without question, Virginia Woolf's and Dorothy Richardson's contention that, quote, since there is such a thing as a female consciousness, women writers must evolve a style appropriate to that consciousness. Quoting from Dorothy Richardson, she blithely accepts the notion that, quote, the female consciousness is primarily aware of or concerned with psychological events rather than with abstract philosophical assertions or with external dramatic happenings. The style most appropriate to such a consciousness would naturally, she says, be some sort of interior monologue, the monologue intérieur. As a result, Miss Donovan comes up with a dictum that, quote, the subterranean level of reality is the province of the woman writer, and points to French writer Nathalie Surratt's work, amongst others, as proof of her assertion. And indeed, Nathalie Surratt does deal with the subterranean levels of reality. The conclusion that this is therefore naturally the province of women writers, however, is patently absurd, because it ignores the fact that the interior reality, apart from, although within the social framework, is a particular area of interest for a great many French writers today, including Robe Grillier, for instance. If she died,